At 12 years old, I was taken out of my house by the police and put into the juvenile system, where I spent the next 6 years going in and out of crazy foster homes, orphanages, delinquent girls' homes, you know, that whole thing. And that was for my safety, if you catch what I'm saying here. This was for my safety, supposedly, which put me in the system, which is like flypaper. By the time I turned 18, I had been arrested, and I was back in the bigger system. I wasn't with Susan, I was the California Youth Authority, and then on parole for a number of years. And for my safety, once again, kind of, and for my safety while on parole, they would call you in, and we had something called the nailing program, where they would call you into a testing facility when they would shoot you up with nailing to test and see if you've been using drugs. And nailing is like naloxone. So if you were in any way strung out or using, you would get deathly sick right there, and they would bust you, and that's how they controlled the situation. And they finally outlawed. I did hear that someone burned down the building, so I thought that was kind of cool. But, you know, this was how they dealt with things in the late 60s, and it was all for my safety. So as a parent, you know, I've watched my son go through 2 terms in the California state prisons. He has 6 felonies. We're in Florida now, so he can't vote. You know how that is, or anything else. And that was for his safety, too, because he was a nonviolent drug user. And, you know, it's like, where are we going with this? And, you know, I'm watching all these kids now with the opioid epidemic. They are dragging kids out of homes and putting them in the foster system. They're going to grow up just like I did, where I got introduced to heroin and everything bad in the world. I learned in that place they put me to get safe. You know, and that's my issue with what's happening now, and that we're just dragging kids out of homes and putting them in foster care and putting them into a system that's going to hurt them more.
Well, Julie, you kind of answered the question.
There's more?
That I was going to ask you, but I'm going to pull it out for everyone on this panel to talk about, is that we are in an opioid crisis. We are in that moment. You know, so there's conversations that are happening all over the country. There is a lot to be critical about, right? Because in places where I'm from, like in New York City, the conversation, the crisis has always been ongoing. It has actually just been the way that we've lived. And it is affecting a different group of people in a different way, right? And we have to be more nuanced in the way that we talk about it. It's not that it's never affected white people. It has always affected white people, just not the white people that the state cares about.
Yep. That's right.
Right? And so it's like, how do we, so now it's affecting the kind of white people that the state cares about.
Yeah.
Right? And there is a different level of engagement. There's a different level of language. There is a very clear idea about what accountability looks like.
Yeah.
And what safety looks like and what we're supposed to be investing in. However, even in this moment where people are saying we can't arrest our way out of the problem, they have already identified the people that are not a part of that spectrum.
Of that problem.
That problem. Those are the people that actually are the problem. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about people that sell drugs.
Doctors, and, you mean?
The doctors, pharmaceutical companies.
Pharmacists, pharma, you mean?
Any user, yeah. Right? Because if we're going to talk about being survivors of the drug war, we know that surviving is a constant state. So even if you move to another part of the spectrum, as Shiloh brought in, you're still under the gaze and the control of the state. And so, Shaquita, I want to bring this to your table. As you live in Louisiana, the question is, in this current state of the opioid crisis, and everyone deciding what safety is, let's move out of the drug war, the kind of stuff around that. Drug sellers have been identified as not a part of that conversation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Louisiana is, we're special, right? We have a really strong law enforcement lobby, which is part of the reason why we're the number one incarcerator. And I think a number of people are left out of conversations all the time, particularly around the drug war. For women with a vision, I think one of the things that we're trying to do to fix that is that I feel like, and I've kind of been in a quandary since November, like a lot of other folks. And I think that one of the things that we've been truly focused on, you know, and a lot of our work is with Black women, right? And so Black women understand the drug war. We've been a part of it for a long time. We've had a lot of losses because of it. And so we're actually doing a lobby day, a legislative day, which amazingly is probably one of the first ones happening in Louisiana specifically for African-American women, right? And what our issues are. As surprising as that is, you know, but for us, it's just, I think that we're at a point where we are truly tired, right? Like, I just feel like there's so much, like, we can't keep with this kind of, yeah, we want to keep communities safe by getting drug dealers off your block and this and that, but at the end of the day, there is economic injustice, there's underlying trauma that people are experiencing. We don't want to address any of that, but we want to continue to incarcerate folks, right? And exclude people from conversations that they should be having. And I just think we're tired of it, you know? And I feel like if I had the answer to what the strategy is, I would be probably rich in this capitalist society because I could pack it up and sell it. But just trying to move people, just trying to keep as many people involved as we can and understanding that there is a good bit of power if we have to play within this system of capitalism and of voting and of two parties, then I think that we're well equipped to try to move forward and be a part of that.
Yeah, and Kemba, I'm gonna come to you here. You know, specifically drug sellers have been generally cast as demons in our society and called everything from terrorist to predatory. Why do you consider this a false narrative? And what structural and social realities are not considered when we paint drug dealers this way, or drug sellers this way?
The fact that I was sentenced to 24 and a half years the first time nonviolent thing is not pertinent. I mean, I don't think that even if I was a repeat offender, that I still shouldn't have received 24 and a half years. But I was a first-time nonviolent drug offender who was a college student who was sentenced to federal drug conspiracy where the federal government held me accountable for 255 keys of crack cocaine, even though the prosecutor said I never handled, sold, or used the drugs that were involved. My 86-year-old white judge, who was sleeping during the expert testimony about the domestic violence and abuse that occurred in my case, he said he wanted me to be a deterrent to others. And so, whatever, he died. He's not gonna be a deterrent. What he did was he allowed me to be a poster child for America and this country to see what a person that gets sentenced under these drug policy looks like. That it's not just your monster that's on the street corner selling drugs, that you are destroying families. And yes, someone may go out there and may not have any other alternative. They feel like that's their only choice to make it in this country because we have broken systems, broken educational systems. People can't get jobs. And so they go out and do something else. But just because they do that does not mean that they should get the rest of their lives taken away from them. And I turned myself in 7 months pregnant, and I can remember the day that I was sentenced, and there was a van full of other African-American males that were with me. And when I got back in that van, you know, I knew what my sentence was, 24 and a half years, but every Black brother that got in the van with me had received a life sentence. And you want to talk about recalling this war on drugs? Well, the deterrent that you thought that I was going to be ever since I stepped foot out of federal prison, I cannot forget all of what I saw, all of the people that I became friends with. And so when I came out, I felt like Solomon in 12 Years a Slave. Because as I was walking out of federal prison, because Black America had taken on my story, They had me on the cover of a national black magazine called Emerge Magazine, and I thank George Curry for doing that and putting me on the cover. But understand that I was a no-name face, that he took a risk to put my no-name face on a cover to highlight Kimba Smith's nightmare, Kimba's nightmare, MA-263-7-0-083. And so I became the poster child for this discussion. And I thank DPA, I thank Deborah Smalls, I thank Asha, because she read about my story while I was in prison. People embraced that story. I'm grateful for it, but at the same time, I was incarcerated with people that, just like you said, America didn't care about them. But I cared about them, and I cared about us. I cared about people who were from different countries and were over here, women that were traumatized in abusive relationships, get caught up in the system, and now they run the risk of, once they serve their time, they get deported back to their country away from their children.
Yep.
So I could not walk out of that situation and just walk away and forget. Not even a year out of being out of prison, I can remember being in a room with Deborah Smalls and working with the people that helped to bring me home. And I was frustrated, depressed, sad, because I could tell that this was going to be time, so much time was going to go by, and I knew what a day was like in prison.
Yeah.
And things weren't happening fast enough, because I had people that were rooting for me coming out of prison that I knew needed to come home too. I have a friend, Michelle West. She's still serving a life sentence in federal prison. She's already served over 24 years.